Cracking Copy is a marketing and copywriting podcast where we lift the lid on writing for business and read between the lines of effective copy.
This is a podcast for creative entrepreneurs and savvy business owners like you who understand the value that great copy can bring to their bottom line.
We dive into a different aspect of writing for business in each episode, debunk the myths about how we should write, and explore the ways that writing can be fun, conversational, and creative, while also being high impact for serious results.
So listen, laugh, and learn with us, Ella Hoyos and Minnie McBride, as we share our words and wisdom in each snack-sized episode. Expect some light bulb moments, interesting guests, and practical takeaways as we crack the copy code together. Hello and welcome back to the Cracking Copy podcast. Today I am joined by a special guest who's mastered the art and the science of conducting customer research. It's a crucial skill for any copywriter, and in fact I am talking to a copywriter, Dr. Mimi Zhu. Have I pronounced that right, Mimi?
It's Mimi Zhu, but thank you for asking.
I should have checked before we started.
It's okay.
But Mimi is a doctor, and I have to say you're the first doctor that we've had on Cracking Copy, so extra special welcome to you.
Well, thank you so much. I've so enjoyed listening to the episodes and hearing all your experts and their different takes on writing and writing copy. So I'm really honored to be a part of the lineup.
Thank you. Yeah, research is a crucial part of any copywriting project, especially if, like myself and like yourself, we're conversion copywriters. We want people to act on what they read. So everyone in our world tells you to talk to your customers, don't they? But no one tells you how. So the fact that I've got you on board today, Mimi, I'm hoping that you'll explain to us, you know, how do we talk to our people, the people that we're writing to and writing for? How do we talk to them and to extract the information that we need to write the best copy we can write? And that's the point of today's interview. Without further ado, let's get into it. First of all, Mimi, can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into copywriting?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I'm a conversion copywriter for coaches and service providers. And so I help people sell their offers so that they can make the impact that they want with their audience while also growing their business. And I got here, I actually completed a PhD in French literature a few years ago. And so towards the end of that, I really had to ask myself if I wanted to continue down that academic route or not. And I actually landed on being a personal finance coach because I had done a personal finance class when I was 22, 23. I sort of lucked into it. I was in the right place at the right time. So I sat in on it and I learned a lot of important stuff about budgeting and investing. And when I was in New York, I was at New York University doing my PhD. I noticed that no one, including the smart women around me, talked about money. And so my idea was that I would, you know, go very far away from this academic world where I didn't really feel that I belonged so much anymore and do something along the lines of empowering women with money. And so I started down that road, but quickly realized that I didn't actually have the background to do that because I had always been in this world of writing and research and teaching. But by that time, I was in groups with coaches and I realized that there was something I could do that they needed, which was writing the copy for their services. So that's how I got my start as a conversion copywriter.
Yeah, right. It's an interesting journey. I'm really curious then, when it comes to research, and you've focused in on this as part of your sort of copywriting specialism now, but why is customer research so important in the context of copywriting and marketing?
Yeah, so if the goal of copy is to sell something, to sell an offer, I think it's really important to understand the person that you're selling to and what their struggles are and what the context for those struggles are. Because I think it's really like it's really easy for people to introduce their own biases. So, for example, I was working with a nutritionist a while ago, and her specialty is helping people eat so that their hormones are balanced. Because her clients struggle with symptoms like headaches and acne and crankiness. And so on her end, she knows that like hormone imbalance is the root cause of those symptoms. But if for her audience, if all they know is, I have this awful headache and I just want it to go away, copy that leads very strongly with hormone imbalance might not land with that audience. So that's why it's important to see what's going on with the audience and how they view their struggles and their context.
So we're looking for the same lens that they're looking through. So we perceive the problem in the same way that the customer does. Is customer research the same as market research?
So technically, I don't think they're the same. So customer research is collecting, I think the goal of customer research is to collect voice of customer or VOC. And I would do that through mining reviews, through surveys, and through interviews. Whereas market research is looking at what is on the market that solves, like the way I would do it, I would look at what's on the market that solves the same problem that I want to solve. So a great way of doing market research is doing a competitor analysis and looking at what people who do the same thing that you do, like what are their offers? How are they positioned? Are there any gaps in the market where a problem is not being solved and that you could therefore fill, which is kind of a smart and potentially lucrative thing to do if you can find a gap and fill that. So I don't think they're the same thing. The first one focuses on who that customer is and how they perceive their struggles. And the second is more getting an overview of what's on your market that you might be in competition with and where you lie in that overview of the field.
Yeah, okay, understand. Walk me through the different types of research then that you do as a copywriter. What are those key things?
So it really depends on the project, but the key things are it's always some combination of what I've mentioned already. So mining reviews. So I love looking for those pages of testimonials that people have up so that I can look at what their audience is saying and how they describe what brought them to the solution that they found and what they think the main benefits of that solution is. It's so easy. It's so accessible. It's so useful. And I also like writing surveys and conducting interviews. So one of the first things that I do with clients is for bigger projects is we sit down and we talk about what the outcomes of our work together they would like. And of course, usually it's copy or messaging because that's the final deliverable. But I also talk about like how they want, what questions they really want insights on. And sometimes my clients are familiar with the methodology that I use, jobs to be done. And so sometimes they'll also want JTBD insights. So that's pretty cool. So then I can write the surveys and set up the interviews with all of that in mind. I do like to do a competitive analysis as well, just so, well, I like to do it because clients like receiving it, and it's sort of it's, you know, I like to go poking around and looking at things. So it's sort of an easy way to deliver value.
Yeah, great. And in that decision-making between, you know, what balance of research to conduct for a client, does it depend on the size of an email list or the size of their following or audience? I'm thinking of surveys in particular. You'd perhaps only run a survey with a company with a large audience to get the best feedback. Is that right?
I don't really think a list size impacts the kind of research because you can have a small list that can give you some insightful survey responses. I mean, you would just know that your answers might not be like statistically significant. So you couldn't necessarily make like a bell graph out of them or something like that. But yeah, I would not be put off running surveys and interviews off of a small list. I think you can, or even off of no list, if you found people who you decided were like ideal audience like, if you wanted to survey or interview them.
Yeah.
I
And
hope that
actually,
answered the question.
yeah, it did. But now I'm thinking it's kind of a flawed question as well, because you wouldn't necessarily, conducting research for a client, just ask their own customers. You might be looking to people who haven't yet tried the product or haven't yet heard of them. So therefore, they wouldn't be people that exist on that client's email list in the first place.
I think it really depends on the project. I have written surveys for email lists. I just wouldn't be put off by the size of the list if anyone is. Yeah, I think a small but engaged list can be valuable.
Yeah. And in that sort of preparation and execution mode of each project, do you have a system for capturing the responses and capturing the data for different kinds of research that you conduct?
So when it comes to tools, I am pretty low tech. So when it comes to mining reviews, I use AirStory by Copy Hackers, because you can capture text and images. I set up the surveys. If a client wants me to do the surveys on my own technology, I just use Google Forms. It's free. It's easy to set up. I can set up the logic jumps. Every once in a while, I have a client who prefers they do it on their own accounts because they know how it works, and they might want a copy of the survey responses, which as a copywriter, you can decide whether to give it to them or not, because you just wouldn't want someone who disputed your insights to necessarily have that research to, if they were gonna use it to disagree with you, I guess. But yeah, but if someone wants the responses on their own, in their own, like on their own accounts, then I'm open to that. And I think that's it.
Yeah. I have to say, having used AirStory, I love it. And if you haven't heard of AirStory, you can look it up. It's an amazing way of capturing what you see on the internet and just taking snippets of text. And there are other programs like AirStory that will, and I can't think what they're called off the top of my head, but you can capture snippets you see on the internet. It's really helpful to have a place, have an easy way to do that. Because you want to build up a body of information, don't you, in order to find those patterns and analyze that data. But yeah, I agree with you as well about keeping it low tech and low key. There are plenty of questionnaires and surveys that you can build out yourself, forms that you can build out yourself to capture that information. So great. Now, when it comes to the type of research that is interviews, one-to-one interviews with clients, especially for that sort of voice of customer data where you want to get really qualitative information. Do you have any techniques or strategies for making interviewees feel comfortable and open up when you're asking questions of them?
Yeah, so I'm gonna say something that people might disagree with. So I'm a little scared to say this, but I have to confess that as a person, I care very much about if the person I'm talking to is comfortable talking to me. But as an interviewer, that is not necessarily my first priority. My first priority is to go into the interview. So when I do an interview, I've already agreed with my client what the main question is, and I try to boil it down to one.
Right.
So it's probably something along the lines of, do we think that for this audience, this is what they really want from this solution? Something along those lines. And I usually write it down on a piece of paper. I have a blank piece of paper in front of me, and it's the only question there. And I'm really aware of introducing bias into an interview. So I try, to be honest, I try not to look too friendly, because I don't want, I mean, I'm kind of not there to be their friend. I'm there to get the information.
Right.
And I don't want them to think of me as a friend either. It gets a little tricky when you start interviewing people you actually know. But so to get people to open up, so the thing that I've learned, I actually just learned this recently, and I'm excited to try it out more and see how it goes. But I don't know if you know who Bob Mesta is. He's one of the founders of the Jobs to Be Done framework.
Okay.
And I was listening to a podcast that he did, and he talks about how when he does interviews, he tries to ask yes or no questions. Like if the conversation's just kind of not really going anywhere, people are not giving information, he tries to get them to know, because when you get someone to yes, you have nothing else to talk about. Like you agree, and you agree on the facts, or like whatever.
Okay.
So he talks about trying to elicit a no, even when he knows it's going to be a no, because when you get someone to say no, they'll then back up and tell you why it's a no. And in that way, you get more information about their thinking process, which is really key to the context that you want to unearth in an interview.
That's fascinating. I always believed, this is probably a common myth, you dispel it now, that that asking yes no questions that elicit a yes or a no is a big no-no in doing research, that you should be asking open-ended questions to allow people to, elaborate on their answers. So to actually specifically ask a question that invites a no, is really interesting.
Yeah, just something to try when the conversation runs dry. I do
Oh.
think it is important to ask open-ended questions, though. I think it's always important to start there.
It seems to me as well that the Bob's approach, as well as getting the no, is the same kind of approach as just pausing after you've asked a question, because people don't like silences, do they? They don't like that uncomfortable silence, and so they will fill the gap, they will fill the void with information just to prevent that silence happening. So that feels like a similar technique to just pausing and zipping it after you've asked something.
Definitely.
I would like to dig a little bit deeper though as to why you feel it's important not to get too friendly on the approach, especially if you're trying to warm up to a conversation. Why is that important to come with a poker face?
So this is something that I learned from Hannah Shamji, who was head of research at Copy Hackers, and she, I think she has her own course on interviews out. I haven't done it, but I've looked at some of her other stuff. The way I see it, so of course I say hello and I, greet them when they come in, and then tell them what sort of take them through what we're gonna do, and I hope that invites comfort. But I do think that they have volunteered their time already, which is kind of a huge step. And so I do assume there's a level of comfort that, otherwise they wouldn't have volunteered. So I guess I kind of assume it. And then part of getting someone to open up, I think, is just getting this conversation started, because they're busy, and I don't think they really want to chit chat on the call with this stranger. So I think comfort is just not my priority.
Well, I can remember, Mimi, I can remember being interviewed by you for a mutual friend of ours, a copywriting coach, and she hired you to do some research into new products and services she was developing. And I do remember being on the receiving end of that interview and it being very, very matter of fact. And we just got down to business straight away. And it meant that the interview was quite short. And I guess that has to be when you're interviewing a lot of people. You don't want to take hours doing it, and sometimes that small chit chat can elongate the interview, and so you are respecting the interviewee's time by just getting straight down to it.
I think the other thing I was going to say was that if you avoid a bit of the chit chat, I think you're more likely to avoid bias, because you introduce bias as someone gets to know you. So even things like smiling. I try not to, I just try to be aware because I don't want to look like I'm agreeing with what they're saying. Because people, and I've been on the receiving end of interviews too, where, you know, I might want to say more. And maybe if the conversation was a little different, I would, like, I would divulge more details. So, but it's going a certain way already. Like, they think a certain thing. I've already said something. It's hard to go back. And there's all these things. So I don't. And I think I'm really just trying to avoid that kind of moment.
Yeah.
So if we just dive in and get into it, that's really what I want.
Yeah. Okay. That's really fascinating too, because there is all that nonverbal communication as well. If you're doing a Zoom interview, so people are, yeah, if they see you smiling, they think, well, perhaps she wants more of this. And they'll elaborate on something where perhaps they wouldn't have done if you kept a straight face. So not giving too much away as an interviewer, to allow somebody to actually speak their truth, yeah, and not to be influenced by you as the interviewer.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. That's really interesting on interview technique. I'd like to talk now a little bit about how you gain insights from the research that you do and how you extract sort of the useful information. Are there any common themes or insights that you look for during your research? I know it varies from client to client, but I'm interested to know if there is anything that you would always aim to get.
So it really depends on what the objectives of the research are. But in general, when I'm interpreting, I am usually looking for two of the frameworks from Jobs to Be Done, and that's the timeline and the switch. Should I dive into those?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think people will be familiar with those terms. So yeah, I'd love to hear more about those.
They're easier to understand with an example. So let's say you're a sleep consultant and you have a course that teaches parents of children 6 months to 4 years how to sleep through the night so that they can sleep through the night. I may or may not have been in this position recently. So the Jobs to Be Done timeline is a way to understand buying behavior. And so if you're the sleep consultant, then the first step along this buying journey is that someone becomes aware of your course. But they won't buy it right away because we're aware of a lot of things, but we're not going to buy all of them right away. But if your audience is the sleep deprived new parent, like maybe they have one really bad night and then they consider your course seriously, they consider buying it. So when I look at research, generally I do look for these moments of struggle, which the timeline calls an event. So what happened in our case, it's that sleepless night by the child. And what did that cause the ideal buyer to do? And that was look at the course. And they still might not buy right away. There can be multiple events along the timeline. But I find that the timeline is useful because it asks the question, what are the moments of struggle? And if I can find those, then I can drop those messages into the copy. So that's one of the frameworks that I find really helpful for interpreting research. And the other one is the forces of the switch. So to use the same example, if you're the sleep consultant, there are four forces, and two push people towards buying your offers and two push them away. So the two that will push people towards your offer are the pushes of the old. So I can't sleep through the night. The pulls of the new, I really want to sleep through the night. The habits of the old, which the majority of the time is to do nothing or do it yourself. So read a book and try to sleep train my baby. And then the anxieties of the new, which are what if the course doesn't work? So looking at the research depends on the sort of the case by case project, but I find these two frameworks are pretty malleable and you can use them almost anywhere.
How do you ensure that the insights that you gather are reliable and representative of your target audience?
So that's a very good question. I think the best way to ensure that your insights are reliable, are spot on, is to do different kinds of research. So that's why I like to triangulate review mining, surveys, and interviews. So for my bigger projects, I do all three, because that is the best chance you have of avoiding bias is through variation. Because, for example, with interviews, when people send, like, happy clients, happy customers are more likely to want to do an interview. They'll volunteer their time. But part of customer research is discovering where people feel an experience has fallen short. It's great to get like all the raves and things, but I also want to know how an offer can be improved. So I'm aware there's like potential bias with interviews. So that's why I think the other two, surveys and reviews, are also useful for sort of checking that and sort of vice versa. So yeah, so I think for accuracy, your best bet is doing different forms.
Brilliant. Now, really, let's move on, because it's all great having all this research and data, but how do you translate those insights into compelling copy? Where do you even start with that?
So what I do is I make a small messaging document for each project. And sometimes it's a part of the deliverable for a larger project. I will polish it up and deliver it to the client so they can use it for their messaging, for their whatever they want, email, social media. So that's kind of fun. That's like a way to provide a bit more value for work that I'm doing anyway. But even for smaller projects, I will make a quick messaging document where I define the messaging hierarchy and sort of rank the pains, probably more so the pains than the desires, because people buy when they struggle. To resolve a struggle. And then I drop those messages into the copy. And if it's pain-led, I'll probably use problem agitation solution as a framework. Good old PAS. And do the usual conversion copywriting things of writing a whole bunch of headlines, writing, like trying out the different subheads. And then using the framework to organize what I want to say and making sure there's social proof, making sure the button copy matches with the headline of that section, making sure the page closes. All the little checklist of conversion copywriting steps.
Mm-hmm. Okay, brilliant. A messaging hierarchy simply means the order and the sequence of which you'll deliver those messages.
Yeah, what the most important messages are in order.
That's fantastic. Do you have any sort of real life examples that you can talk about? Because I know some of your projects are more confidential, but where you've used customer interviews and customer research insights to create some compelling copy.
The example that comes to me that I can talk about is when I did this for myself. So I rewrote my website some time ago now, but to do that, so I was working with Betsy Muse, who we sort of mentioned earlier, where I was doing interviews for her, our copywriting mentor. And so I was working with her. And so I did all the customer research for myself to write my own materials. And so when I interviewed people who were sort of within the range of my ideal client, one of the things that they kept, and so I would ask them probably something along the lines of what the desired goal of their copy was. And the phrase I kept getting was that people wanted it to be client attractive, which I understand, it's what we all want. But the research part of it comes in when you understand that the force behind that is really wanting more sales and to grow business and grow income. And so The way that I put this into my own copy, and I still do this is I try to always make sure what I'm saying ties back to the sale, so that it's just the value of what I'm saying is very clear to the ideal person. So I think the homepage headline I have right now is, "Your premium offers are easier to sell with premium copy doing its job for you." So I decided not to take the exact phrase "client attractive copy" because it's what they want, but they're not saying what they want. They want sales. So I try to highlight what they haven't said they want that they do want.
Yeah.
This is a bit of a confusing example, but I hope it's helpful.
No, I understand. I mean, that is a challenge, isn't it, that you face when conducting research, that sometimes what the person says they want isn't necessarily what they need, and it's a pattern that you can extract on you as an experienced researcher. You can see, you can read between the lines. I don't know if this is how you would term it, but once you've done a body of research and you've interviewed people and you survey people, there's some things that will emerge from that that you can see that perhaps it may not be their exact words, but it was the intent, it was the sentiment behind what they said. Are there any other common challenges that you face when conducting your research?
I think the biggest challenge is in the lead gen stage, and it's finding people who already understand why research is important. Because everyone, I think many people understand that they need copy, but there are also many people who think that something like ChatGPT can write that copy without where yes, it will write the words, but I don't see yet how it can do the customer research. Maybe it can mine some reviews, but it can't like get the same kind of information from surveys that I've written, or interviews that I do, which are sort of reverse engineered from the client's goals. So I think that's honestly, I think the most important part is in that stage. It's finding people who understand that research is important, and people who don't want copy, that's just pulled out of thin air. And so I'm not sure that this is very original, but the way to do that is to the challenge is really to find those people. And so the way that I do that is by talking about research in my marketing, in my email newsletter, so that I have a sense that at least like depending on how someone has heard about me or how they can talk about some of my stuff on the discovery call, have a sense of where they are in the understanding that research is important and that different types of research are important too.
Okay. What advice would you give to copywriters who are new to conducting market research, but who want to give it a go for themselves? Are there any basic tips that you could offer?
Yeah, so I would start. Well, I guess I have two tips. So the first tip to keep in mind is that you want to define what the ideal outcome of your research is, because that will really give the research direction. You don't want to do research, like there's no point in collecting data just for the sake of having it. Like if you can't use it. So be clear about why you want that research, and it might just be for messaging and for copy, and that's fine, but just be clear about it. And the second tip, I guess, is I think review mining is just the easiest thing to do. I think if people even did half an hour of review mining and found a few pages of testimonials and read them, I think they would. Like that goes a long way for helping someone get familiar with what their ideal audience is struggling with and what outcomes that they want.
Yeah. So this is finding reviews and the similar product or service that you're offering. It's finding people similar to your situation and seeing what people are saying about these similar products and services.
Yeah, it's finding people who are competitive with. with your own offers. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much, Mimi, for sharing your insights with us today. I'm sure our listeners have gained so much from your expertise on customer research. Where can people find out more about you?
So they can subscribe to my newsletters, Smarter Customer Research, where I share once a month, kind of like how I did in this episode, a customer research concept with examples and how to turn it into copy. And they can also find me on Instagram and LinkedIn.
Great. And we'll share your contact details in the show notes as well. So thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And I've loved hearing about how you tackle your research projects.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be included on the podcast.
You have been listening to the Cracking Copy podcast with Ella Hoyos and Mimi McBride.
Don't miss out on future episodes by making sure you hit subscribe down below to keep up with all our podcasts.
And more details and resources are in our show notes.
So we'll see you next time.